Hello, I'm John Waters, and I'm supposed to announce there is no smoking in this theater, which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard of in my life. How can anyone sit through a length of a film, and especially a European film, and not have a cigarette? But don't you wish you had one right now? And I'm telling you, smoke anyway. It gives ushers jobs. And if people didn't smoke, there would be no employment for the youth of today. So once again, no smoking in this theater.
Your live show.
On your live leak. Cody, how were tryouts this morning?
Really, really cold. We didn't get a ton of people, admittedly. We kind of cut it off. We pinched it off, to use a Daphnis phrase. We pinched off tryouts a little early because it was snowing sideways for a period of time. But then we went over to Moose Bar, a local haunt, as it were. I had a couple of really, really hefty Coors.
Hefty Coors?
Glasses. Yeah, a couple of hefty Coors, as they were, and a fire and ice shot combination, as I was telling you all off mic, and that's what brought me here today.
Matter of fire and ice, as they
say. Yeah, but they were okay, so my fingies are still warming back up, but I don't know, all things considered, it's been a successful day so far. We'll see what this recording holds, but I'm optimistic.
I can see your fingers turning from sort of a grayish, colorless paste into like a beautiful, warm Technicolor right before my eyes.
Really, really, really upsetting you use the word paste there.
I thought it was evocative, Jason.
Thank you.
Oh, I try you're a writer.
That's what we try for here on Try Love. It's a literal roundtable podcast where we talk about movies we saw, people we met at or through the Trilon Cinema in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You can find us on Twitter at Trilove Podcast. Find the Trilon itself at trilon.org. Cold as my marble, I'm Jason Daphnis, and you can find me on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
I lost my head. I'm Cody Narveson, and you can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narveson.
A weak mind isn't strong enough to hurt itself. Stupidity has saved many a man from going mad. I'm Harry Mack, and you can find me on Twitter at Punishtake.
This is my ass. Big, isn't it? My name is Aaron. You can find me on Twitter at RBPlease. And my big ass on Twitter as well.
He's never ass posted. Do not take him at his
word. I just
show my ass every day, though. So,
nice.
Something to think about.
Is that why my phone keeps telling me that RBPlease wants me to follow him on Threads? Is because you're ass posting there and it's like, it knows what
Does
I want.
Does it keep telling you that?
Yeah, it keeps telling me, like, Seth, your friends, Seth, and whoever, like, you and Seth are the ones that it keeps pulling up, but sometimes it'll interchange a couple. And I'm like,
we're waiting
don't.
For you.
Nobody
it's like,
ever
yeah,
asks.
I haven't posted on Threads. I regret signing up for Threads. I regret clicking whatever that button was.
False.
That automatically
claims.
Made me a Threads account. Yeah.
Disgusting. I should say, before we get talking about today's movie, today's film played at the Trilon in March 2024 as part of a series of two by the Archers. That is two films highlighting the 19 that were made between 1942 and 1957 by filmmaking duo Emmerich Powell and Michael Pressburger from their shared production company of that name. There's a piece by author Lucas Hardwick on Perisphere, the Trilon blog, highlighting parallels between this film and the final episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, which I've never seen. Probably a nerd. Respect Lucas for it. By the time that you hear this, of course, it will have left the Trilon screen, but there's so much more to see there. I'm giving my plugs up front so that I don't have to squish them at the end. This spring alone, you've got series on Charlotte Rampling, Harvey Keitel, a vertical slice of a bizarre subsect of Bollywood I've never heard of, a series on the swords and sorcery craze of the 1980s, say that six times fast, something called Luchador Lunacy, and way, way, way more. Check it out at trilon.org. But before I do any of that, before you do any of that, I need to... I suppose it's not so much ask a favor as it is just like because it's one of his core responsibilities.
Make a demand,
podcast.
If you will.
I will ask, like, are you ready to introduce this movie as you usually are, Aaron?
Yes, indeed, folks.
Great to hear.
Yeah, we're talking about A Matter of Life and Death, 1946 film directed, as previously mentioned, by Michael Powell, and Emmerich Pressburger. The film starts.
Did I get
David
it wrong
Niven.
Or did you get it wrong?
What do you mean?
Because I said Emmerich Powell, Michael Pressburger.
Aaron's right.
It's Michael Powell.
See?
And Emmerich Pressburger.
Thank you.
What did you say previously?
I said Emmerich Powell and Michael Pressburger.
Just edit it. Just swap it. Right. You know what I mean? Just do a swap.
Emmerich.
That's right. The film stars David Niven as Peter David Carter, a member of the British Royal Air Force in World War II. His plane is going down. The rest of his crew is either dead or kind of bailed out. He unfortunately does not have a parachute. And right before jumping out to kind of end it all, he has a conversation and kind of weirdly falls in love with American radio operator stationed in Britain, June, played by Kim Hunter. Peter should have died, but Conductor 71, this kind of angelic being, played by Marius Goring, misses bringing him to heaven due to the terrible state of British weather. So he is sent down to Earth to retrieve him in this sort of It's a Wonderful Life-esque kind of scenario. Also in the film, and notable, Roger Livesey as Dr. Frank Reeves and Raymond Massey as Abraham Farland. This film is like a lot of the other kind of Powell and Pressburger films, regarded as you know, highly influential on film in general, but British film specifically. We'll kind of talk about it. We covered Black Narcissus recently as well. That's what I got. It's regarded as, you know, one of the best films.
Yeah.
The AFI list, the Sight and Sounds, the British specific list, where it's like, let's just name the best British film. You know, let's just.
There's no other world outside of these.
You know, let's, Wicker Man. You guys remember that one? Yeah.
There is. I'm sort of with this short series of Powell and Pressburger movies, having a bit of an Ernst Lubitsch moment. In the early days of this podcast, we covered a bunch of Lubitsch films, and I was just even having some familiarity with you know, I won't say antique, but films older than 50 years old. I was still surprised by how fun and modern and strange they could really be. And this Powell and Pressburger series, short though it is sort of giving me a lot of those vibes. Like, I would say that they don't make them like this anymore, but I honestly don't know that they ever made them.
They never made like them like this.
Yeah. Like,
yeah, I mean, that's a really good point.
It feels to me, this movie, A Matter of Life and Death specifically, Black Narcissus to a different extent and with different, you know, results, but like, it feels both like novel and self-aware at the same time. It feels like casual and earnest at the same time. It is like visibly old fashioned, but also revolutionary in how like old and new the experimental film techniques are. It's a weird feeling where I can list like movies that give me that resemble it visually or in plot, but nothing like, there's no accurate descriptor I can pull out that's like, yeah, this movie is like that, or that movie is like this. So what I'm wondering is, maybe Aaron, since you introed this movie for us, what kind of feelings did it leave you with when you saw it? And are there any comparisons that you're able to draw that feel apt?
Yes. I would say that it is a film that, as you kind of mentioned, like, is, I think, easy to compare. I mean, I said It's a Wonderful Life, something like the... what's the Wim Wenders film that I'm forgetting the name of? Wings of Desire, something like that, right? I think that like this is a movie that, from a kind of, you know, technical standpoint, from a filmmaking standpoint, kind of is in, you know, kind of a certain lineage. But I think that this kind of storytelling is something that is from like an even like kind of larger lineage of films about, you know, the afterlife, and about the afterlife kind of coming and interfering with day-to-day life. And I think that like a lot of those stories are quite interesting. It feels like very Dickens in a way as well. Right. I think that there's a lot of stuff you can compare it to from a story standpoint, but I think like, as you mentioned, like the filmmaking aspects are very unique. I think that it is a visually striking film. I think that like, interestingly enough, I think the most visually striking aspects are like often not the parts in heaven. I think that like, you know, Powell and Pressburger do a great job, and the cinematographer, who I should really quickly look up, Jack Cardiff, who I did.
Jack
also did Black Narcissus. He just shoots the hell out of just like,
maybe the goat rooms. Man.
I mean, it's crazy. The shot with, or the, you know, the scene where, you know, our main character is like sleeping in an armchair in this library, just is with sprawling books, right? And it's just like this kind of, you know, golden hour, like kind of sun just beaming through the windows. I mean, it's like immensely beautiful. Like, I kind of think that it's maybe much more beautiful than all the scenes of heaven, which is like slightly pointed, but also like slightly not, right? Like, I think to the,
I feel
like
both ways about it as well, right? Like, I think that's part of the point.
Yeah, continue. You can take it.
Oh,
from there
yeah.
If you want.
No, I mean, I love that point, right? Like, I love that in this movie, heaven is black and white and ruled by law and sort of static and eternal. And it does a really remarkably good job of just visually. This isn't even necessarily something that is textual within the auspices of the movie, because the movie has too much more to talk about. But it makes this great comparison between heaven and life, and makes the case that life is beautiful because it is dynamic and vivid and fleeting and
messy
and dramatic, right? And like it does from the very beginning of this movie, you are like stepping into this heightened environment where those things are true, and where somebody can fall in love with somebody else in the span of a single conversation because they both think they're going to die, right? And it makes this he thinks he's going to die. She's fine. She's not going to die. She's just in her radio headquarters. But I think that like that's just one example of a bunch of examples that we're going to get at, where like this movie is communicating so much and on so many different levels, and is also just like this unbelievably almost bizarre experiment in filmmaking. I felt like I was really taken aback by how like much fun they must have been having. Just like it, you can totally tell they were just throwing things at the wall, right? Like, what's every single cinematic idea we've ever had, every single sort of technique we've wanted to try? Let's find a way to make that happen, and let's weave it into this narrative in a way that genuinely enhances the themes and the ideas of what we're trying to communicate here. And I think that like almost every single technique of that sort of kitchen sink that they try works for me in that sense. What do you think about that, Cody?
I would agree with that. And it plays, you know, there's a shout out to the Trilon. They show a lot of great movies, or movies worth like delving into in more detail, whether that's on a hot mic or not. And like, I definitely had a certain apprehension of, you know, like we ended up covering both of the Archers sort of movies. We did Black Narcissus last week, Matter of Life and Death this week, TBD on if we hit on any of the Harvey Keitel movies. But I think it is.
Oh, Kelly's so mad at me about missing all the Harvey Keitel movies. I'm like, listen, we had a guest. I don't know what to tell
movies.
You.
We're just juggling all these good movies. What do you want?
We're juggling all these good movies. We can't hold all these limes. I think it is maybe worth suggesting that something about the Archers films is like calling out to us. It sounded better in my head. But I am grateful that we did this as a sort of supplement to Black Narcissus or Black Narcissus or vice versa. And that like we can see firsthand the potential joke. He's not a joke. He's the goat, Jack Cardiff. I conflated the hard G and the soft G. Jack Cardiff, hard at work. The opening sequence of I don't know. Like, we'll have a goat cinematographer at the end of the year is what I'm saying. That's going to be a category at the Golden Berries.
Spoilies.
We'll determine it. Spoilies. It is March. We've got time to figure that out. But the opening sequence, tapping into the sorts of things that we saw with Black Narcissus, more so with the Red Shoes. I think the sort of unabashed, fearless close-ups in this sort of soft, ethereal lighting. And
I love the word fearless for it.
Yeah, yeah, because it feels like that, right? And then we break out into it feels like the sort of maximalization that we got with something like Black Narcissus, but it's also sort of tempered down when we're considering something like this is how heaven operates. But it's all visual. All of that lifting is done from a visual standpoint. I'm watching, I forget his name off, but like the guy who's he's waiting for squadron leader Peter Carter. He's waiting for him. And like through his eyes, we get an idea of how heaven operates, because like he's learning it. And just as we're learning it, we're seeing spatially, it's, you know, people are brought up and they get to this platform, they sign a clipboard, and then they go forth into whatever happens next. All of that is done extremely, it's done silently. Like Harry said, we're probably going to get into a lot of like technical examples, but this is, I think, something of a display of technical mastery. There's something intimidating about going into this movie, or at least like the sort of, I didn't do a ton of legwork before watching this movie for the first time, and not for nothing, watching this as the precursor to Black Narcissus. That is a double bill as Jesus. It's kind of a lot. But like the freeze framing that goes on, not just the framing of Peter in the library, I think, as Aaron mentioned, but then that getting followed up with, hey, this is how we're evoking like the cosmic sort of interference where we're freeze framing. There's nothing wrong with your television screen. This is just, this caricaturish Frenchman, conductor 71 coming down from the heavens to interfere with things that are going. I think it is also something of a cheat code that, you know, evoking something like It's a Wonderful Life, that, if you have such a grasp such as this of things from a technical perspective, if you can evoke things, in the cosmic sense, these are the cosmic machinations of our world. If you can like communicate that in a visual medium, it's kind of like, well, obviously that's one of the best films ever made. But we watched it. We're here talking about it. This is, I don't know. I have no idea what that ties back to what anybody brought up, but this is a good one. I am ultimately glad that we all watched this, at the very least. And then we get to dig more into it. But that's, I didn't see who was next, but please take the baton from there.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the Powell and Pressburger-ness of this movie, because this one, especially after The Red Shoes and Black Narcissus, it feels like it has some of their most distinctive tropes, right? Which one of them is the big fearlessness, the technical mastery, the technical experimentation and unbelievable creativity that they come at these movies with. But also the fact that that is sort of, and we talked about this a lot on Black Narcissus, and maybe it was because I was thinking about this movie, honestly, because I watched this movie before Black Narcissus, but it's all in service of this almost ironic lack of, I don't want to call it like reverence for the source material that it's working with, but it's this willingness to be funny and unsacred, I guess, and unprecious with what you're treating. Like, I would call this movie almost a comedy, right? Like, it is a drama. It is a melodrama. It is a thriller in some ways, but it's so funny. Like, I'll be the judge or the prosecuting attorney Abraham to Aaron's Brit lit loving person and say that, like, this reminded me of nothing so much as like Twain, in that, like, it's dry and funny and cosmic, but it's also a cosmic joke, right? Like, this is sort of it's a cosmic farce, right? Like, this idea that heaven operates this way and that, like, you have to, like, defend your life as a British person against the most, like, a biased American hateful dude of all time. And I really love how this movie, it does all of this incredible creative stuff, and it's all in service of, like, something that is so funny and casual and vivid and modern, right? It brought me to, like, my favorite point that Kelly made, actually, so shout outs, but it was like, I didn't even, like, put together that this movie came out literally a fucking year after the end of World War II. And, like, reading it through that lens really transforms this whole movie, and I'm excited to talk about it. But that is just to say, like, that was not my first takeaway from this movie, right? Because, like, it feels so eternal. And it feels so like big, right? That it could have been made so much later than it was made and still make so much sense, right? Like, I felt like we're dealing with something that's really eternal here, and it is all of those things, and it is still, like Black Narcissus, genuinely hilarious, genuinely silly at times, and so uninterested in being, I don't know, I don't want to use the word pretentious because I hate that word, right? But, like, so uninterested in being sort of like prestige, like, filmmaking the way that you might think of it as. It's so much more interested in just, like, how can we have as much fun with this as possible?
I really like that we started with, like, how it sets that stage. Cody, you were talking about, like, our comparisons to Black Narcissus. One of the things that I really loved talking about on our episode about Black Narcissus was the way that it sets the stage with that. It's one of the first scenes where we have, like, a fly around view of Mopu, of the basically the area where the movie takes place, up high up in the Himalayas, and how that like gives us a really good sense of space and what conditions the nuns are dealing with and sort of like where they have to go, where they're going to be throughout the movie. And it really does like create a sense of character for that place. Impossible in this movie to do that because it takes place between two different like realms essentially. But I think right off the bat, it's very good at setting that, like it uses the same tactic. The opener, basically the text scroll is non-diegetic, speaking directly to the audience about like where this is taking place and what considerations need to be made here and what is what you're about to see. And it's literally a cosmic scale. You're just looking at the cosmos. You're seeing like different stars exploding and shit. Side note, I read in a couple of different places that the filmmakers consulted Arthur C. Clarke at the time for like their depiction of the cosmos. I have no idea if that's true or if that's ephemeral, but like a nice consideration that they give, like, I guess the best word I can come up with it is is like that consideration for what you're seeing and how it's being framed, setting the stage for the rest of this movie. Because the way we've been describing it, I can't imagine that you're listening to this if you haven't seen it, but the way we're describing it makes it sound like so many other movies, like a movie where, you know, like Heaven Can Wait, the Lubitsch film, like where you have to sort of like weigh the scales on if somebody deserves or doesn't deserve something. But it's also like Harry's hinting at much, much bigger than that, in its like implications and its actual direct storytelling and its script. But I just hesitate to think how the movie would flow if not for setting that tone right off the bat of like, there's this cosmic, Harry, you called it a comedy. I think it is pretty thoroughly comedic. It's farcical. It's got that very, like they reference Shakespeare a lot in like sort of like the all consuming conversations that these people have. I think one of the things that you said in your Letterboxd review is like how most of it is just people having interesting conversations in rooms with each other, even to like where the third act comprises just this celestial court room drama that we're just listening to different sides. I'm trying to set the stage for it being a much, much bigger picture than you know, the intro might make it sound, because that's where like, what Aaron was talking about with the visual experimentation and some of the really strange stuff that they do. It's like there's, you know, a movie in a shape and it says, okay, from the beginning, we're going to sort of like push out to this shape and it's going to be on a cosmic scale. It's going to be about love and life and death and, you know, that whether a human would deserve this thing just because of a mistake in the cosmos. And then it pushes out in another weird way. And it's like, what if he's just suffering from epilepsy constantly? And I think
Like Twilight Zone Act Two twist where it turns out it could all be like a brain injury thing. I love that.
I think that's pretty obviously what happened, but that it doesn't matter. I think by the end of the movie, it does not matter whether he's actually going to something called that we would call heaven or if he's just hallucinating at all. And in these other weird ways, like, again, you know, non-diegetically, what the audience is seeing, these really strange, really evocative images and stuff. It's just like building its weird shape in so many different directions in the first and second acts, so that by the time the third act comes around, again, comprised by a black and white, essentially courtroom drama, where people are like arguing over the value of love and life and law and reason and the soul in it, the scope of eternity, you're like riveted. You're ready for whatever strange thing happens next because of the strange things we've posited before that happened. So like there's an intentionality, a consideration for the flow and what you're seeing and in what order, rather than just like this scattershot of ideas. It's like, yes, there's an incredible creativity to this, but also a discipline of like, if they see this thing first, if they consider this concept first, then they'll be more ready for, oh, we're going to pit these scales or the scope of this argument where much, much larger. It's going to be, yes, it's going to be about country and about imperialism and about, you know, the world stage immediately following World War II. But it's also going to be about, you know, specifically these two people. And it's also going to be about the, you know, continuing balancing the scales of life and death. It's a fantastic way that it builds itself to that point. And then by the time that it does, it's just incredibly emotionally affecting too. It's very like humorously sad and, you know, it tugs at the heartstrings. That's why I'm having a hard time putting like a descriptor or finding like, oh, this is like this movie, because it uses like the pieces of fucking, it looks like Brazil sometimes, not literally the place, but the movie, it looks like Brazil sometimes. And yet its core conceit is love and reason rather than just absurdity. And it's just leveraging all those different feelings to like this not novel, but very, very true end result. You know what I mean?
I think it'll come through in the final draft, but I think I got the handoff well enough. And I don't know if this will be anything more than like a connecting piece, but I feel sort of the same way, especially you cited the second act and you used the phrase scattershot of ideas, which I think is pretty appropriate in the sorts of things that are foregrounded in the first act. And then the second act, just as far as casting outlines, where two things in particular, one being the kind of like mental illness angle, like the insertion of Dr. Reeves, Dr. Frank Reeves as a character, where he's got a real deep voice. He's got an imposing, but like friendly presence. And like, you want to like this guy. Like, there's something comforting about the way, like Roger Livesey, the actor, like his presence on screen. There's something like gruff, but like kind of comforting about the way in which he comes into this. Like you want him to want to be somebody who wants to help this guy. And like, he's very skeptical, and you come to find that he comes at it from, I don't want to just again chalk it up to like the mental illness angle, but like he kind of, to Jason's point about like, you come to not care, come back three, about whether or not this is something that is getting manifested in his mind, or if it is quote unquote actually happening. But that is, something that is introduced alongside the kind of second thread. It's something that I started to reconcile with towards like the end of Act Two and then going into Act Three, but like life and death being like adjacent to the I don't know, like it's kind of haunting that the focus for this is like, as I think Harry said, like the fact that this movie comes out a year after the end of World War II, and just like, this is, it's hard not to come into this with that very actively in mind of like, yeah, we're going to see the machinations of getting into heaven and what that looks for, a shitload of soldiers, like the visualization of all this, hundreds of people who have died as a result of a war that ended up happening, assuredly. And I couldn't help but think of Porco Rosso amongst all that, the sort of way that Hell they choose yeah. to visualize those sorts of things, that was definitely creeping into my brain come Act Three again specifically. But all that is to say, maybe it's kind of a choose your own adventure as far as like which one we jump onto first, or we are feeling ambitious and tackle both at once. But this seems to have evoked something from Harry. So I don't know, how did that hit you? I know you and I, Harry, saw this a couple, like a week, 2 weeks ago, and haven't revisited it since. But like, how does that all hit you now, a little bit removed from that experience?
Yeah, thanks, Cody. There's so much to talk about here, and I think that's by design in this movie, right? I would say that if I had one grievance with this movie, to be honest, it is what you just described, which is that it's almost the victim of its own success, in that it is straddling and almost transitioning between so many different stories and so many different genres, that the experience I had with this movie was one of being utterly charmed and utterly won over by the last story, and then becoming skeptical of the next. Over and over again, right? Like I loved when it opened and the universe stuff was happening, I was like, okay, what's happening with all this? And then by the end of it, I loved that. Then when you know, the plane crash is happening, I'm so won over by that. I'm so invested in these two people and their love story that when the doctor is introduced, I'm like, what, do we really need this, guys? Like, do we really need this sort of like intellectualizing of, and this like weird sort of like love triangle, it's not really a love triangle, but this like camaraderie between the three of them and like the relations between Britain and in America. And then I was won over by that. And then, you know, like the court case itself starts and I'm like, oh, I don't want a bunch of jokes about British US relations. I want to keep paying attention to the melodrama. Like I love these characters so much. I don't want this movie to transition into something else. And so like, the movie's constantly transitioning into the next thing it wants to evolve into, and I almost wasn't ready to leave behind. It's a victim of its own success in that way, right? But I will say that in almost every case, I'm not as huge a fan of the third act of this movie as I am the rest of the movie, to be honest, but in almost every case, it completely ends up winning you over again, and it does that just through that that really like characteristic combination of what Jason called like creativity and discipline, right? Where it's like, it's all of these incredible ideas, but at the same time, they're also fully formed and completely devoted to what they're trying to depict. Like, for instance, I think that like we've talked so much about the technical mastery, but like, yes, like the script in this is so good and so clever and so funny that like, I was, in addition to everything else happening on screen, just completely like won over and enamored by the fact that, like Jason said, like so much of this movie is just people having conversations. And like that is treated with the same reverence and the same interest as all of the other visual stuff, right? Like there's not a single conversation in this movie that is not going as hard as the technical stuff is, right? Like it's all of the like dialogue, all of the interactions, all of the relationships are exactly as sort of overstuffed with meaning and comedy and creativity as anything else in this movie is. And it makes it so that like, you know, like I said, like I almost didn't want the plot to keep going. I didn't want to get to the court case because I was like, I'm having such a good time like with these three characters fucking playing ping pong in like the doctor's office, which by the way, year of ping pong, between this and Long Day's Journey Into Night. I'm just saying, keep it in mind, big ping pong scenes happening. I don't know. It's just like this movie, it on some levels, it's so cohesive. On another level, it's like 12 different movies and they all work better than they should. Right. And they're all sort of like brought together by this, like this just overriding incredible competence. That just makes it seem easy to balance genres and tones and plot lines and characters the way that it does. So that like you could see this going on forever and ever and sort of like evolving and mutating into something else the way that it does over the course of the movie over and over again and continuing to work the way that it does. It just like it has that effect on you.
I didn't know if this was going to be. Harry kind of hinted at this. I didn't know this was going to be like a hot take that I was going to be a Debbie Downer or something. I think the courtroom scenes in this are not good, to be quite honest. They're my least favorite part of the movie by a lot.
I would say that they're my least favorite part of the movie by a lot, but they're not bad.
Maybe bad.
But
they're,
that's
yeah,
fair.
They're not
yeah, yeah.
bad
yeah.
per se. I think that like it is weird that this movie that you know is so like creative and like weird and kind of quirky
becomes a bunch of kind of like stale jokes about America, British, US relations.
I mean, that is weird. And I don't especially think that really fits in, but given like this film coming out in 1946 and like being about what it's about, I guess I'm willing to go along with it. I just think it's like, it's shot weirdly in like a very boring manner. I think like there's a lack of visual creativity that is like, yes, you could argue like part of the point due to like the, you know, the kind of sterile nature of heaven being this kind of black and white, you know, very clean, environment. But I think that like, just the way that like the shots are composed even is like very kind of standard. And I think that like the rest of the movie, even other shots of heaven, like the, you know, the staircase scene is wonderful, right? The shot where, you know, they're looking out through these little like skylights into the world below. Like, I think a lot of that stuff is like really beautiful. And I think like just the courtroom scenes are like weirdly not that, except for that one shot where it kind of pulls out and you see it being, you know, this galaxy cluster. I think that's quite nice, but it's weird to say, yeah, because it's like that should be the most visually creative, interesting part of the movie, and I think it lets it down a little bit, but also like not too much. It's not like it sours the entire movie for me. I just thought it was kind of a weird thing.
Yeah, I think that's buoyed enough for me. The third act, the courtroom scenes, I think it's buoyed enough by the scripting is generally very, I think, very good. It is, if in the most simplistic way you could boil it down to, it's a bunch of like sort of nips and jabs at, you know, British imperialism and American individualism, and sort of like both sides have something to say type. You could probably do that to it, but I think it's just like, because the scope has been like brought in to that extent, I think crucially there's that kind of long scene where before he actually dies, I think it's Frank Rees, the doctor who's sort of diagnosing him and trying to get him treatment. He explains feverishly to one of the surgeons that we need to get this man operated on tonight something is happening to his brain, that he's going to lose his imaginary trial and he's going to probably die as a result of it. It's, you know, this is not a medical drama, but there's that scene where, like, at length that's explained and sort of immediately transitions. I think the camera even points at a wall toward the staircase pointing up to heaven where Peter is riding up the staircase with the French fop, with Conductor 71. And I think it's just like, that is sort of a pivotal scene for me of between what we'd come to expect as the movie, the sort of like his survival and, you know, his, whether or not he's going to get to stick with his love, and this like the sort of more dry courtroom drama. Is there's connective tissue there, one in that scene where like explained and contextualized. But if we're going along with the whole thing of, you know, if Peter is in fact hallucinating all of this, then he would of course assign a certain like dryness, directness, and and discourse, I guess, to the way that human, the Frank Reeves, would like conduct something like that. Everybody's sort of in all the official folk anyway are sort of in a very British looking, magistrates type outfit. I think it's cushioned enough by that and by the fact that it does just keeps moving, even though the shots aren't as dynamic as the rest of the time. I'm actually seeing here on Wikipedia that Jack Cardiff took a few days off during shooting. So I probably just, yeah, I think that is,
I fucking knew it.
Listener, I lied. There's enough of like what we've already built up and enough on the line, but also enough lightness throughout that I didn't feel like that slowed down too much. I think that things are like, because they're as tightly scripted as they are, even if it's not as visually impressive, like it's hard to beat one, the elevator, and two, when Peter, I think, closes his eyes maybe for the last time as he's going under into surgery, there's literally from inside of his eyeballs and like,
dude,
the veiny,
oh my God.
That's, I mean, I know we're trying to pepper very in like disturbing. Our favorite shots and the freakiest things throughout instead of having a whole segment about it toward the end. That is a defining shot of this movie because in 1946, imagine trying to sell anybody. We can discuss how bizarre it is that this even exists after we're done here. But I think it's, you know, feelings lodged about Harry and Aaron, both appreciating but not feeling like it was the strongest part of the movie, the third act courtroom drama. I think it was on par probably with the setup and the sort of like body of the thing. I really liked that segment. Cody, did you have an opinion on how the third segment gets there and what we do when we are there?
Oh, I got an opinion. Yeah. I think there's enough of a lubricant that has been laid down in the first two acts. I think somebody communicated this better than using the term lubricant in the positing of that. But like there's enough from the preceding
they
acts,
the rails.
They grease the rails for us to slide through these courtroom scenes. I think the failing is maybe in how the failing is not in how the sets were put together for that. In my mind, I love how the court, like when I used the term maximalization earlier, and in that sense, they were sure to insert it in, like, I forget which character says it, but some communicates that there's a vested interest in this case in particular, because this is something that takes place during the war, and because this is something that is focused, like the fulcrum is how love factors into, you know, like ascending to heaven versus
what's
like
love got to do with it, if you will.
Yeah, this movie would have been more successful if it were released under its original title, which was War, what is it good for? There we go. I nailed it completely. Jason can edit around that.
Sorry, I think you mean war. Ugh, what is it good for?
Absolutely nothing. The stakes are communicated through the production design and how this courtroom is set up. We've got, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of people in like the stands as spectators, and the camera is like is good at, you know, it's worth. It notes, hey, these are people in like mostly as they're gestured at by like the attorneys. I don't know courtroom lingo. That's why I'm kind of flailing about as I am right now.
Plaintiff, bailiff,
plaintiff, objection, overruled.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I am not a lawyer.
Yeah, technically speaking. And I do like that Frank is like kind of on a pedestal. That's like the kind of hokey shit that like, hey, look at him. He's like up on a platform by himself. Like that stuff sort of works. There is, and it does kind of feel weird that I like we're poking holes in this. It is I don't think it's bad by any means. It is like the, and not even like a misstep, but it is, I think, like the weakest part of all of this. And I, in how it's framed and how like the, like this does not, measure up to, we're talking about the staircase scenes and, them like ascending up to heaven and then him running back down, like that all works in a way that feels completely different from like how the entirety of the third act is framed. Again, I think the production design does not lose a step throughout, just something about how we get to the courtroom scene and choosing to hone in on, again, like the British imperialism of it all and those sorts of gags that almost takes away from like the rest of, because we're just honing in on what the jury is and just like close-ups on jury members and like going down the line, like that takes away, it takes away from the maximalization of this all. That being said, this is something of a masterpiece. Like I can only knock this down so far. I still very much love this movie and I'm looking forward to revisiting it, but that does feel, now that we're, and probably just like the recency bias of us like talking about it and getting kind of riled up about it, like there is probably something there of like we wanted to get to this point, why this point in particular, and why did the visual language want to focus on these sorts of things in particular. That feels, it was certainly a choice and probably a choice that made more sense, in the early half of the 20th century when this was made. But, yeah, I don't know. Harry, do you want to poo-poo on it some more?
Did we do kind a good job? Of. I don't know. I mean, yeah. I ended up circling back to like, when I say like it's a victim of its own success, I think the success part of that can't be underestimated, right? Like, I not to play sort of armchair or Monday morning quarterback or something, sports reference there, Cody. Is it Monday or is it Sunday?
Monday night football is a thing.
Oh, usually Tuesday like, morning. What, one or quarterback two games?
Then. No, not, well, I,
it's the day, it's the day after. All right. Never mind. I don't know what I'm talking about. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury. That is just to say, like, it seems clear to me that like probably the courtroom stuff was the original idea of this movie. And they sort of like backfilled from there. They were like, oh, this is what we want to do, is sort of like a guy who's trying to prove that he deserves to stay alive because of love or something. And I don't know if that's true. I'm just speculating. But like the entire movie is a long build toward the courtroom scene, right?
And yes,
it is so good at building the tension and building the drama and building the excitement toward the courtroom scene that I would almost argue that nothing could sort of like live up to the expectations that we have for that scene, right? It's like, this is already one of the best movies I've ever seen, right? Like one of the best movies ever made. And it's all like preamble to what's supposed to be the end. And then we get to the end and all of a sudden, instead of being about the characters and being about the sort of like existential cosmic interplay between life and death and like what it means to be alive and what it means to, it becomes sort of like a series of jokes about US British like relations post World War II. And like it became obvious to me like they spent so much time with that like it became clear that that was like what the movie was supposed to be about in some ways, right? Is like communicating these jokes and this sort of like idea of relations to a very, very recent post-war US and Great Britain. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but I think especially for a viewership like us as far removed from it, you know, like Jason, you had said that like there are jokes here that are critical of British imperialism. Obviously that's true. And this is a British like production, so like they're not as hard on America, but like right from 2024's perspective, like the kinds of jokes that are made about both of these fucking empires that spent the rest of the 20th century, it must be said, ruining the world. In together. Profound and historically unprecedented in many ways that have defined our lives as people that like it's almost quaint, right? It's sort of cute and it's a bit like a victory lap, which again makes a lot of sense in 1946 and makes less sense now. But all that is to say, like it's amazing, given the characterization that I just gave, that the movie still pulls it off as well as it does, right? Like, for one, the jokes are fucking hilarious. There are a lot of really, really good jokes in here. One of my favorites is when the Abraham, the prosecuting attorney, if you will, he sees the main character and he's like, "Your smile's not unattractive." And he smiles and the guy smiles back at him and they're kind of having a moment. And then he drops it and becomes dead serious. And he's like, "Did you use that smile to seduce this good Bostonian woman?" It's like so good, right? Like, and there are a bunch of jokes like that that just like, I like, it can't be overstated how modern the humor of this movie feels, right? How, like, I was watching this in a crowded theater of people and we were all laughing our asses off throughout this movie. And like, I don't know, like, it, the movie made me laugh and it made me cry at different moments, right? And like, there's really something to be said about how successful it is, even if sort of in the moment, moment to moment, and especially at the end, it can't fully pull off what it's trying to do, almost because I think that its ambition outstrips like the material it has to work with almost. Right. And I don't know how I would improve upon it necessarily. Yeah, I don't know. I think that like, so I agree with what everybody's been saying about the third act, but I almost wonder if it's not like, I almost loved it as much as a sort of like glimpse into what Powell and Pressburger were trying to accomplish with this movie all along, right? Because I think that like, for all of its other like sort of like tensions, I think that the this movie, which is already pretty didactic and pretty melodramatic, it becomes extremely didactic in the third act, I think, and in ways that are both sort of heartening and comforting and frustrating, because it has to sort of necessarily lose a little bit of the satirical, farcical fun that it's having in order to arrive at that point. But what do you think, Jason?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think maybe it's upon second reflection that the courtroom scenes work better in retrospect as like, remember, this is the movie where we started off with a celestial look at the, you know, a look at the celestial bodies and a consideration of the place of love and emotion and logic and reason in all of that. And then moved into one of the best scenes of the movie is at the very beginning, I think, where David Niven and I forget the actress's name, but the love of his life, are sort of bandying this very dark but very witty conversation back and forth about like his imminent doom. He says like, "You are life and I'm leaving it." It's just like a very, very good, I think, scene to remember that it's the same movie that where we had all of that very like, very quick, very witty, very like throughout the movie, you know, following that scene, there are a lot of very well-written scenes and some incredible acting and obviously a lot of visual experimentation and just rich, rich cinematography to remember that, oh, this is the same movie where that happens. It doesn't feel like a ball has been dropped. It's like, oh, we're holding it in a different way. We're like using, it's a very strange part of a very strange movie, I guess is the best way I can put it, that I don't feel like it's run out of a certain juice or that it's like sort of changing course. It's just like got a different, it's looking at a different part of this same concept. Like if there wasn't this conflict within him and we didn't get to see the conflict, then it would be easily discarded as like a figment, you know, maybe he would die or maybe he would live, but it sort of like doesn't have that weight. I think those two pieces like belong with each other. The courtroom scenes don't have weight without knowing everything that's come before it, and sort of everything that's come before it feels a little bit too flip if there's not a like an examination there, you know, fun and humor driven though it is like it has that more dire, dour setup of courtroom drama, not a whole lot of music cues going on. And when they are, it's very like suspense driven and sometimes cheeky. I think that those pieces work pretty well together, but I understand even in the moment, I was like, where are we going with this? In the moment, I don't know that it worked as well as when I was done with the movie. I just thought back to the preceding 100 minutes and thought, okay, we had this clear arc. We got to this point with that. I felt like they were a handshake moment sort of thing, rather than we've lost momentum, we've lost speed. We have like this sort of like questioning why we were here even after we were done with it. I guess I just rolled with it. I was able to roll with it a little bit easier. Harry, any thoughts about the final thoughts about the final act?
Yeah, well, I think that what you just said about the strangeness of this movie can't be sort of understated, and it's also like my favorite part of this movie. Just sort of like anecdotally, I went to see this movie with my sister and my mom. Shout outs to Cody, who was also there. It was nice. He got to meet my mom. There you go. It was because she's a huge Powell and Pressburger fan, and this is like one of the only movies of theirs that that she hasn't seen. And so she was really excited about it. And then like we got out afterwards and she was like, I was like, what did you think? Wasn't that amazing? She's like, eh. Like for her, I think it was like legitimately too weird and too sort of like sci-fi and farcical for what she expected, which was maybe something more like Black Narcissus, right? Or something like The Red Shoes, two of her favorite movies. I can sympathize with that. And I also think that's like a really demonstrative sort of reaction to have about this movie. And to think about that reaction and transpose it to when this movie was contemporary is really fascinating, because like, I can't believe how lightly and how much fun they have with these concepts that would have been so like devastating for the people watching this movie, right? Like it's a 1946 movie. So like pretty much everybody who saw this movie would have been touched in some way by World War II, right? Like, especially like the British and American audiences, like many of them probably lost family members and or loved ones. And it's incredible to like, to imagine that like this movie, it manages to be in my mind like perfectly respectful and beautiful in honoring the memories of those people and their importance and continued importance in the world, while also like being so funny and so light as to sort of almost like comfort or help like de-traumatize the moment a little bit, right? And I think that like it has to be the sort of strange movie that it is in order to accomplish all of those things simultaneously. And I think that there's really something to be said in 1946 about making a movie about the sort of like farcical, cosmic, ironic comedy of what it is like to be alive and how these concepts nonetheless are worth making film about and worth exploring, right? Like the idea of love, the idea of love as being transcendent, the idea of love as being like something stronger than the laws of the universe itself, or something that will endure, something that matters even in the face of even in the face of time and of tragedy and of war. I think that like It's so fascinating to think about like what Powell and Pressburger must have been trying to accomplish with this movie during that time, and how much of that is perfectly resonant to today, and how that even feels like part of the point, right? It's like this movie feels like a movie that is so of its time, and at the same time, like prepared to project deeply into the future and sort of just remind us about like what it means to be human and what it means to love, and why those things are still important to remember no matter what happens. And I think that like, that's what I say when I say that like everything about this movie is that like whether it's farcical, whether it's funny, whether it's dramatic, melodramatic, beautiful, romantic, it's all like, it's all so united by that one point. And that point feels so like intimately targeted at its audience in a way that is like so beautiful and moving to me, right? Like this feels like a movie about like helping people take the next step after World War II to me. And I just like really admire it for that.
Yeah. It's telling that in that interesting I was talking about where he's going down in the plane, it's like they have a moment that no two humans should be able to have, like your last moments and developing something there. And it's like over the course of the movie, it almost feels like these people are being punished for a thing that humans should not know, like a closeness to death, so to speak, like a recognizance of one's mortality, which I think is a read that rings a lot stronger when you consider, yeah, the audience is fresh off of one of the most like lethal international conflicts that yet happened in history. That like
is international conflict too, if you will.
International boogaloo. That leads me to, obviously it's a movie that like is just steeped in a lot of really cool visual experimentation. Don't want to take too long because this is no longer a segment. We killed this segment. It's dead with a stake through its heart. But I want to ask, what are those pieces? We just like talked around them a little bit. I imagine at least Cody, maybe I put you on the spot a little bit because I know that you're a note taker during movies, parts that you just like stuck in your brain visually that made you like consider what it was doing, the experimentation on display, the sort of scattershot creativity or direction. Give me some examples of what you saw that you remember most from this movie.
Totally. And thankfully for you, one note that I'm looking at that I took while watching this movie was Ping Pong LFG. I always love Ping
You're
Pong,
the pong baby.
Representation. You're the Pong. TBH. Stay tuned for this year's Golden Berries. To be quite honest, whenever Ping Pong gets depicted on screen in a movie, the people playing Ping Pong are usually pretty bad. The people playing Ping Pong in this movie, honestly, not half bad. Yeah. I would still whip their asses, but like they're still like
they got trained like, by pros.
They did.
They did. Yes. I don't know if you're going to bring that up. Sorry to undercut your point.
I'll let you comment on that if you want. But they like it looked way more authentic than a lot of Ping Pong play does in movies, and the fact that they used that, coupled with again the shots of looking at Peter Carter, him in the study or what have you, kind of cutting back and forth, and then there's just like that freeze frame, and there were like a couple seconds in our screening where like nobody said anything. There wasn't any like oh what's going on, nothing like that, but there's definitely that sort of terseness of like what the fuck's going on over here, and then you get this, it's like oh, time has been stopped because our favorite conductor 71 coming like that. So two means of visual innovation. One, the people playing ping pong on screen actually look like they know what the fuck that they're doing. And then the second one being the kind of cosmic interference where we're fucking with our usual expectations of visual language in, you know, like a standard sort of movie, without, you know, heaven's interference from up above. It's simple change, you know, like freezing a frame is not like the most mind-boggling sort of technical shit that you can do. I mean, I'm saying that with a very 2024 brain, but like within, you know, at that moment in time, it was one of the more I don't know, kind of wild things that could be done to sort of like fuck with our sense of stability while still like keeping us in check. And like you're able to kind of go forth into that like very not heavy or heady necessarily, but like it's a conversation scene that has consequences for like the movements that follow. You need to be able to like refocus, recalibrate, and like, you know, pick up the lines of information that are getting dropped. So I don't know, that in particular stood out to me. It's the first one I think of. It's probably not the most groundbreaking, but it's the one that stuck with me a lot.
That and the use of Technicolor, I think, are the two overarching broad ones. Like the ones that can come and go and are like narratively important for that is just really interesting to see it. I mean, I know that it wasn't a new technology, but like the sort of creative fun use of it. And again, looping the audience in what the audience would expect. There's a shot where he's being brought back down from Peter is being brought back down from the staircase back to like our realm. And instead of like, you know, shot to shot, the color changing, it actually like the whole frame fills slowly with color again. And it's like, I've seen that before. Of course I have, but I've never seen it before with like the intent and meaning here of like, oh, there's something is returning to him. He's returning to something. Rather than just like, look at how cool and beautiful it can look. It's that, but also there's a narrative purpose to it. I think both the, like you're saying, the stop motion, not stop motion, the paused motion and the use of Technicolor are the two things that draw like the most response for me. And like, I already said it, but that shot of where he's closing his eyes, that goes on a lot longer than I would have thought. It's a lot more detailed than I would have thought. And it feels like something out of a sci-fi film from 1980s. But I did want to leave it open to anybody else who had any examples of that before we get to our final segments.
I love the rose garden scene. where the conductor first comes down and he says, "One is starred for Technicolor up there," which, by the way, in the theater, people like literally cheered and clapped when he said that line. It's like one of the great lines of history, right? I love that line. I love when the doctor is like looking through what his assistant calls his camera obscura, and he's just sort of spying on the town through this like upside down camera lens through which he can see the entire town. That's a really brilliant moment. I really love the shot when Conductor 71 throws the Book of Chess Moves across the Stairway to Heaven back to Peter, and Peter, as he catches it, it transitions from black and white back into Technicolor. Just fucking unbelievable, amazing stuff all around. Just like, again, just like exulting in and having so much fun with creativity as this like life-affirming force, right? Like, I think that this movie is so life-affirming in a way that like just makes you excited. And I think that especially in 1946, that makes it really moving to me.
Aaron?
I think that, yes, that scene, just the color on those flowers is like incredible. I think the aforementioned ping pong scene is just like beautiful lighting in that. I also think the scene right before that where Dr. Frank is chatting with Peter over they're doing, you know, him and June are doing a chess match. And he, you know, makes him look ahead and then to the right. And he looks at the woman who's kind of standing up with the long legs. That scene is like, it looks incredibly beautiful. If you go back and you just like watch that specific scene, it's just, there's like so much busyness going on. There's so much like character and color and like texture. It's just, yeah. I mean, the best looking scenes in this are all just, you know, really good looking, kind of normal with scare quotes environments. Mm-hmm. I like all that. And then, you know, the stairs and everything is great too, but yeah, it's just a beautiful film.
Yeah, it really is. My first, junk drawer thought, and I am going to go through with this junk drawer thought is, I had a moment where I was like, it's really cool that they're commenting directly on the seventh seal, dour death, challenging him to a game of chess thing before I realized that seventh seal was like 11 years after this movie, if I remember correctly. It was like in the late 50s. This movie was 1946.
Wait, what? I fully thought that was a seventh seal reference.
I thought it was too. Am I being a complete
That's
goof
crazy.
About this? I'm pretty sure that seventh seal came out.
I mean, playing like chess.
No, like with the concept isn't brand new, but like I thought it was a direct like. Howard Pressburger looked at that and they're like, oh, that's sort of a sad, negative way to look at death and the contrast between life and death and the reasons you might stay alive and the reasons you might die and you might, you know, be damned for eternity kind of thing. And said, oh, we're going to make the most colorful, French Parisian fop who smells wonderful and brings color and life to everything around him. We're going to put him in there. And he's not even going to play him at a game of chess. It's going to be a courtroom drama. I thought that was like a fun spin on the thing as opposed to like, oh, not the original concept, but it's this take on death is going to be actually this guy kind of is the harbinger for all intents and purposes. He is the harbinger of death for Peter. And he's like this very compelling, kind of annoying, cloying, sweet character.
He's so good, man.
He's
God.
He's so fucking good. And yeah, the whole like starved for Technicolor thing. Really one of the things I cannot believe.
Fucking like
I haven't
Lumiere
heard reference before.
From Beauty and the Beast before he became a candle.
It's such a strong fucking, you know, king of the Trilon 2024. We'll see. Any other junk drawer thoughts? And don't be precious of my time.
Weirdly, one of the most affecting things in this movie to me is Dr. Frank Reeves' character arc. Like, what an unbelievable, like, God-tier homie that dude is. That he dies, and the moment he gets to heaven, he's like, all right. I'm needed. It's time for me to be a part of this court case. It's like, doesn't even spare a thought for the fact that that motherfucker just died. Like, his life is over. Like, he will not.
Yeah, but
like,
heaven's real, bro.
I mean, heaven's real, sure, but like, that's exactly like of all of the different like afterlife depictions I've ever seen, where it's like, hey man, like as soon as you die, you're gonna be called in to help a homie out. Yeah, it's like fuck yeah, like that's what I want. Like exactly that is like shout outs to Frank Reeves, like the badass like renegade doctor motorcyclist who is also the greatest neurosurgeon of all time. And like, but when he dies, he's not like, oh no, like. my practice, like all of the people I could save with my neurosurgery. He's like, all right, I gotta be part of this court case about these crazy kids who I love so much. It's like, man, what a G.
There was
Harry gets to heaven and they're like, yeah, we're gonna let you in like just a little bit here, but like, hey, we haven't cleaned the restrooms in the waiting area for a little. Yeah.
I'm exactly.
Do you think you could? Yeah.
The movie literally makes a joke about that, right? Where like one of the pilots is like looking down at this like endless eternity of people filing shit into filing cabinets to keep up the like organization of heaven. And he's like, oh my God, this is heaven, isn't it? And then like one of the like angels, Riley, turns to another pilot and goes, see, there are plenty of people who would think that working all the time is heaven. And it's like, fuck.
Is it Kathy Byron? Kathleen Byron?
I think so.
From Black Narcissus actually is that angel. That's the creepy lady. From,
yeah.
Anyway, the other thing I want to bring up, that's a hell of a dude's rock moment. The other is when Bob, the plane guy, he calls him his Sparks, the guy who dies before Peter does in the plane that's going down. He is talking to Conductor 71 about, you know, the character of Peter and who he is. And he's like, he's, you know, a pretty reasonable fellow, unless he's had a few. And the Frenchman's like, I don't understand the phrase, had a few. And he's like, beers. And the Frenchman's like, ah, beers. And they just have this moment about beer just for like
all men are brothers.
Exactly. It's an all men are brothers. Anyway,
also the Sparks character is so funny because they set him up in the first act like he's clearly going to be the guy to defend his boy in the third act. And then like right before, as he's preparing to, Dr. Frank dies and it like his best friend is like, actually, this other guy who's way smarter than you has to do it. Sorry, bro. Like you could just sit this one out.
So good. Junk drawer thoughts before we close up this drawer. Wow. I see a lot of heads shaking. I appreciate it. We have one final segment after this junk drawer. That's what we like to call. I was trying to speed things up a little bit.
Cody's Noties.
Wow. All right. Hey, thank you, gentlemen, for that angelic introduction. In honor of a matter of life and death, this week's segment is a platter of life and death. That's right. We'll be talking about movies that leverage poisoned food as a plot point. We nailed it, folks. One at a time, I will read off a trivia item related to a movie that includes mention and or utilization of a poisoned food dish. I'll use the spinner app to determine the answering order for each question. Points will be, you know, all that. Use your noodles, not your Googles. With that, we'll start with the classic modern example of this, Phantom Thread. My question for you all, how tall is Daniel Day-Lewis? Daniel Day-Lewis, how tall is that motherfucker? Pulling up the spinner app here, and I'm going to give it an old spinny spin, and it lands upon Aaron. Aaron, how tall is that son of a bee?
I think he's 6'4".
Aaron thinks he's 6'4".
Should have been hooping.
God, he should have been. He would have been a great point guard. A lot of teams need someone like him. Speak of the devil, Harry. A lot of teams need someone like Harry. Harry, how tall is D-Day Lewis?
I'm going to go with 6'1", Cody.
6'1" is the guess. And over to Jason. How tall is Daniel Day-Lewis?
I don't think he's very tall. I'm going to say 5'11".
5'11" is the guess for Jason. According to online sources, Daniel Day-Lewis is allegedly 6'2" tall. 6'2", Harry was closest by an inch. He gets the point. Next, hit upon the French Dispatch. I'm not going to be recapping the plots of these movies that allows them to fit this criteria. You can look those up on your own. We're on a time crunch. The French Dispatch story in particular would take some time to get us caught up on.
Because it's three movies.
Also, yes. But rest assured, there is poison food that is involved with all of these, French Dispatch included. You can look them up. French Dispatch, much of the film was influenced by the real life history of the New Yorker and its writers. My question for you all, what is the, according to the most recently made available count, what is the circulation for the New Yorker? What is the circulation for, I'm just going to keep using son of a bee. And that goes to Jason first. Jason, what is the circulation for the New Yorker?
I'm terrible with these numbers. I'm going to say 1.5 million people.
1.5 milli. All right, gotcha marked down here. I'm not great at these either. This is, I think, the first time that we've gotten into a question like this, so that is extremely understandable. We'll see if Aaron can help provide us some guardrails for this. Aaron, what do you think?
Yeah, 1.5 milli. I mean, yeah, I have no clue about this. Did you specify specifically print? Right.
Yeah. Print circulation. Yes.
Print circulation. I'm gonna say 1.25 million.
All right. 1.25 million. Sure. Sure. And over to Harry for his guess. Harry, what do you think?
I'm gonna go with 2 million, Cody.
2 million says Harry. The most recent count that we have, which oddly enough is from December 2019. I don't know if the pandemic hit and they were just like, fuck it, we're not going to count anymore. December 2019, the New Yorker circulation is 1.2 million copies. Oh. Aaron gets the point.
Pretty clean.
Yeah, journalism's in a weird state.
The most Irish among us gets the point.
I bet it probably jumped during the pandemic. I bet Jason Mackin would be correct if there's a more, you know, like up to date.
Sure.
But I'll take it.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair. Hey, I'll check in next week. Assuredly, we have a March 2024 account. If we don't, well, dems to breaks. Let's move along to Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. There's a poison apple. That one's easy enough to recap for folks. But Snow White, hey, in the interest of snow and sticking with the hyper-local nature of this podcast, my question for y'all is, how much snowfall has accumulated in the Twin Cities area so far this winter? Bringing it back, folks. And the first person to guess this year's snowfall, this is a depressing question. Aaron has the first guess. Aaron, I know you're not here right now, but how much snowfall have we gotten?
Very unfair question. I don't know what an average or anything is. I feel like it's been a slight year, which we'll continue to see, I would think. I'm going to say let's say a 1 foot 8 inches.
1 foot 8 inches.
That seems way too little.
So 1 foot eight inches, that's 20 inches total by my count. Yeah. Yep. Perfect. We got it. 1 foot 8 inches is Aaron's guess. The next guess is going to come from our own local Harry Mackin. Harry, how much snow?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really going to be showing my ass if Aaron gets this better than I did, but like I don't remember like any snow this season.
I know.
So like I'm going to go with like 8 inches of snow total.
All right. 8 inches of snow got you down. Hopefully you're not showing your ass, because it is actually kind of cold today. I don't know why I'm spinning the wheel, because the guess goes to Jason. So Jason, how much snow have we gotten?
Process of elimination. You can put me down for 25 inches.
25 inches? Says Jason. Alrighty, got you down. From what I can gather on the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources website, the Twin Cities area has received roughly, 14.3 inches of snowfall. Jesus. Which actually 14.3 by 0.3 inches. Aaron wins that question.
Jesus Christ.
Aaron, you know, physically far away from us, but close in spirit.
Close on the pulse. Yeah.
Yes. And I'm actually close to you.
Mentally right beneath us. Right
now, he's, he's behind me, isn't he?
Miracles happen once in a while when you believe. Quick look at the scoreboard. Aaron has 2 points and also a gun to my head. Harry has 1 point. Jason has no points currently. We've got two more questions here. Our fourth poison food film is Good Burger, the movie based off the All That sketch. A few years, I couldn't tell you, I've never seen the movie, but poison food plays a role. I read the Wikipedia synopsis and control plus F lends credibility. A few years back, the LA Times published their power rankings of the best fast food burgers in the country, going up to 23 slots worth. My question for you is, which spot on the list is occupied by Culver's? Midwestern favorite, Culver's. Oh. Culver's on that list. I'll just say it is on that list. This isn't a trick question. Culver's is on that list. Which of those 23 slots does it occupy? And I'm spinning the wheel, and the first guess is going to come from Harry. Harry, where does Culver's lie on that LA Times burger list?
I'm going to go with number 3, Cody.
Pick number 3, my lord. All right, got you down for 3. Moving along to the next person in the queue, which is Jason. Jason, where's Culver's?
I'm going to say it's number 7. You said a list of the top 25?
23.
23. Michael Jordan, number 7.
And LeBron James.
Top 3rd, for sure. Number 7, please.
Number 7, please. And over to Aaron. Aaron, where do you see Culver's being on this list?
It is a list of the top 23, what specifically, again, burgers, but what fast food burgers?
Fast food burgers, yep.
I feel like, and it was LA Times, you said? Mm-hmm. I feel like they're going to
have a bunch of shit. So you know fucking In-N-Out is number one. Right,
a bunch number of negative other, two. Even you haven't heard, you know what I mean? It's going to be like a bunch of like regional, like there's 3 in Sacramento bullshit. I'm gonna say that they probably do not respect the superiority of Culver's as an institution. I'm gonna say 8. Right. I think it's down below that.
Right, number 8 got you down. The Midwest favorite Culver's is number 7 on the LA Times best Ooh. Burger list. Jason got it right on the nose. And that
do you know what the other numbers are?
Well, number 1, number 2, Thank 3, you. 4, yep. 5, 6, 8. I can't.
Keep going. List them all.
I did not. Well, 8, 9, that's where I'm kind of out Let's of my Google element.
Google for the list of the top 100.
They're on the internet somewhere. I didn't make note of them. But hey, this is free press coverage for LA Times. They're not a supporter of this podcast, so actually don't look them up. Just make them up in your head. For our final question, I'm going to ask each of y'all to attempt to rank the aforementioned 4 movies in order of greatest to leastest box office intake. Worldwide box office, taking into account all releases and re-releases to date and not adjusted for inflation. And I'm going to list those 4 movies again in order of us hitting those in the questions. So we have Phantom Thread, we have The French Dispatch, we have Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs, and we have Good Burger. Those are the 4 films you're ranking of greatest to least box office Hall. My grammar's all over the place, I'm sure. You get a point for each correctly slotted film. And like we said, there'll be 4 films total in the mix. If you get the order perfectly correct, that's 4 points to your total. If you get 2 of the films slotted in the correct places, rather the right spots, then you get 2 points, and so on and so forth. Again, Phantom Thread, French Dispatch, Snow White, Good Burger. Those are the 4 films you're ranking of the best box office haul down to the most pitiful. And our first guess is going to come from Jason. Jason, have I vamped enough? Do you have an order for me?
You have a Good Burger. Again, a big old black hole for me, so I'm just putting it where I feel. Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs, number 1. Number 2, Good Burger. Number 3, French Dispatch. Number 4, The Phantom Thread. Sorry,
gotcha.
Just Phantom Thread.
Gotcha. Yeah, drop the, it's cleaner. So I'm going to read that order back to you just to make sure I internalized it correctly. So I have Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs, and then Good Burger, followed by The French Dispatch, and then Phantom Thread bringing up the rear. Is that accurate to your guess?
Correct. And if you'd read me my total, I can come to the second window to pick up my order.
Beep, beep. Did you order through the app? And moving along to the second guess, we have Aaron. The gross man himself. Aaron, what's your guess?
The lack of inflation adjustments really fucking me up here. But I am still going to say that Snow White was the biggest. I'm going to say Phantom Thread is number 2. Good Burger is number 3. And then French Dispatch, I thought, kind of flopped a little bit. I could be wrong. I'm going to put that at number 4.
I just assume that Wes has more like pop appeal than PTA. I don't know.
I know.
Interesting.
PTA definitely has more. Phantom Thread was maybe like 200 million, you know, like something like that. Yeah. I could be wrong.
Is he wrong? We'll find out in a few moments here. But just to make sure I heard your guesses correctly, I have Snow White, followed by Phantom Thread, followed by Good Burger, and then French Dispatch. Did I hear that correctly?
That is correct, Cody. Thank you.
Roger Dodger, thank you. And over to Harry for his guess. Harry, what say you?
Yeah, I wrote down the exact order that Aaron did, but in the interest of having a chance to win, I guess. I'll go with Snow White at number one. Let's see. Phantom Thread at number two, French Dispatch at number three, and Good Burger at number four.
Gotcha. Okay, I'm going to read those back just to make sure I heard those and transcribe them correctly. I have Snow White, and then Phantom Thread, and then French Dispatch, and then Good Burger. Did I hear those
correctly?
That's
correct. Thank you, Cody.
Yeah. Hey, thank you. And so I've made some final tabulations, and just to get ahead of it, thank you. This has been a platter of life and death. I will now read the correct ranked order of these films in order to highest to lowest box office haul. In first place, with the commanding 185 mil approximately, we have Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. The second place film, a significant step down, 48,700,000 thereabouts, and that goes to Phantom Thread. The next film down, pretty close call, 46,333,000 thereabouts, that goes to French Dispatch, followed by Good Burger at 23.7 mil. If my tabulations are correct, I'm going to start from third place, move up to first. Jason came into the final question with a point, got two in the final question, which puts him at three. Aaron came into the final question with 2 points. He picked up two in the final question, which puts him at four. Harry came into the final question with 1 point, and then, son of a gun, he ran the gauntlet, He did the honorable thing and didn't get any of those final ones wrong, and ended up with five. So 5-4-3, a close contest. Everybody did more than just getting on the board, which is very heartening to see. But I see Harry with the pop-off platform. So Harry, that goes to you. Have at it.
You know, I mean, I was going to guess what Aaron guessed, and I just didn't. So let that be a lesson, I guess. Do the quote-unquote honorable thing. That's all I got.
Do the honorable thing. That's the underlying message of Ammo Lad.
It's my favorite Spike Lee movie.
Do the honorable thing.
Do the honorable thing.
Be good on your fists.
That's Spike Lee's remake of Do the Right Thing set in feudal Japan, which sounds like something he would actually do.
Get ready. Thank you so much for listening.
Washington still on it.
To try.
Love. Why not?
Thank you, Cody, for ending our episode as you did. On a more fun note than it even started on, we have more programming here on Trilove. It'll follow the Trilon's programming, so go there to find out stuff about their schedule. Check it all out. It's Trilon in the Heights is doing the Hitchcock 125, I think, this year. So check that out. It's starting, I believe, in April or May. Check it all out at trilon.org. Check out our backlog wherever you get podcasts. Check out our podcast at Trilove Podcast on Twitter. There's that Perisphere piece I should point you back toward from Lucas Hardwick comparing this movie to the last episode of Star Trek The New Generation. Check that out in the show notes or at perisphere.org. It's a blog that the Trilon runs. Me, I'm Jason Daphnis, and you can find me on Twitter if you want to at Nintendoofus.
Thank you for listening. I also want to note that tickets for the MSP International Film Festival, I think by the time that this episode drops, will be on sale to the public. With us recording, tickets are on sale for like the opening and closing films for Film Society members only, but tickets are on sale. There's it's a juicy slate of films. I'm really looking forward to seeing a lot of these movies, so pick those up if that interests you, and look to support them. Please do that, and support the Trilon as well. I've been Cody Narveson. You can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narveson and Twitter at Cody_BH.
I've been Harry Mackin. You can find me on Twitter at PunishTake.
And I'm Aaron. You can find me outside of Cody's house right now.
Oh, hey, Aaron.
Members of the jury, as Sir Walter Scott is always saying, in peace, love tunes the shepherd's reed. In war, he mounts the warrior's steed. In halls, in gay attire, is seen. In Hamlet's dances on the green. Love rules the court, the camp, the grove, and men below, and saints above. For love is heaven, and heaven is love. will you please consider your verdict?